This is how an article by MU journalism professor Catherine Reed begins. I'm just going to read it now, okay? Here goes. It's the kind of story certain to attract an investigative reporter. A powerful industry is dumping a product onto the market that scientific research has shown negatively affects public health. In this example, the industry is journalism, the product, wall-to-wall, no-holds-barred coverage of mass shootings. That's a powerful indictment of how our industry, the news business, handles mass shootings like the ones we've been talking about this week in Dayton and El Paso. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and the professor who wrote that article is going to talk to us about it in a minute. But we want to hear from you, too. How has the nonstop coverage of these mass shootings been affecting you? Is it satisfying your need for information or causing a level of anxiety that's actually interfering with your ability to think and talk about what's happening? Or anything else for that matter, share your story at 816-235-2888. Catherine Reed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are not making the argument that we shouldn't cover mass shootings, obviously. Can you describe the kind of coverage that concerns you?
A lot of what I'm worried about and others are worried about in this sort of loose coalition that I'm part of that's trying to change the way mass shootings are covered is what happens in the breaking news phase in particular. There's just so much coverage and so many almost irrelevant details published in this quest to find an answer to the question, why? Like, how is it possible that a human being could do this horrible thing? And I think that's what drives people to do this kind of reporting. Reporting on details like the killer had a funny walk, or in the case of the Las Vegas shooting, one person said in an interview, I don't think he'd ever even shot a gun before. And so some of this information is intended, I think, to, and this is through telling us more about the killer, it's intended to get us at a why. And we actually, and not me because I'm not a psychologist, but there is a lot of information about who tends to commit these terrible crimes. But this reporting is repeated over and over and over, and it's in the breaking news phase. And
can I just jump in and say, for a while, I had a long commute to work, and I had stepped back from journalism, and I remember hearing after one mass shooting, people were like slowly getting access to the perpetrator's apartment. And
right.
There were like these two ways, which is the journalism speak for like the anchor of a program is talking to a journalist who's out there in the field. And they're like, so what do we know? And they're like, well, we don't know very much. And then they just like kept talking.
Right. That's the problem with a lot of cable news coverage of these events. They have to keep talking. It's just the way those news programs are constructed. And unfortunately, there's this unconscious, I don't think it's fully conscious, urge to answer the question why through these what sometimes seem like absolutely silly details about the killer, as if one of these details is going to lead us to that magical place where we finally know and we can stop these things from happening. So in the realm of psychology and some of the people that I'm in contact with through this coalition that I mentioned are, you know, they're frustrated by this reporting in particular because they say, you know, we know a lot about who these people are and why they do the things they do. And that's what leads us to the issue of the problem of all this publicity around the killer. It creates almost a sort of folk legend around the person. And the problem with that is that it creates a possible contagion risk. And so if there is some, you know, it's usually a young white man who is alienated, isolated, angry, and perhaps even suicidal, and access to guns or the ability to go get them, and that's not difficult, then these terrible things can and could continue to happen.
And yeah, I mean, your main concern here has to do with potential perpetrators out there among news consumers and how the media's handling of the stories can encourage more of the same.
Well, we're giving them a platform, and we're giving them a very
powerful platform.
A platform for attention.
Is it just attention or is it a platform? Like, it feels to me a little like maybe the public outrage and sadness, like it's a platform for making people sad, too. Could it be that?
I think that what we so I'm a journalist by training. And so I kind of want to limit
my enough.
I'm not a psychologist, but I think that there is a strong need for recognition. I have not been recognized. I'm going to be recognized. Or as the famous quote from one of the recent mass shootings, the world will know my name. You know, this is the problem. And this is why we are recommending, and we're not the first to say this, there was a group of survivors, families of victims of the Aurora Theater shootings, who started the No Notoriety campaign. And they were, really early to say this publicity is risky. The names that we should have in our mouths are the names of the victims and the people who are surviving catastrophic gunshot wounds, not the names of these killers. And what we're doing is we're feeding right into this sort of machinery for attention.
You know, and I wonder if you have seen examples of journalism performing what could be like a model of journalists doing what they should be doing in the aftermath of a mass shooting. Can you talk to me about what it looks like to get it right?
Sure. Showing a great deal of restraint about the use of the killer's name. It's really interesting. I propose in that IRE article that was in the IRE journal that you read from at the beginning of this conversation, I suggested that journalists take a story or a script that they've written for a mass shooting, and that means, you know, four or more people died in it, and take out the killer's name and substitute it with the killer. And by the way, I am pointedly using the word the killer and not the shooter, because to me the shooter evokes video games, first-person shooter, and it really to me isn't suggestive of the fact that people die.
Yeah.
Yes, the impact. And the fact that, you know, if we're talking about shooters, then people are just targets. And that really bothers me. So that's why I keep saying the shooter. I keep saying the killer, excuse me, instead of the shooter. So if you substitute, you know, the killer for the person's name in a story, nothing is lost. You know, where it's important to say the killer's name is once, right, when the person is arrested. And after that, it is really of no value. And it's an easy exercise, and I encourage journalists to try it, because it in no way diminishes the value of the reporting. The person's name is not important. What's important is, you know, what are the conditions that created this opportunity, and why, to the extent that we can, and not in the breaking news phase, which is a really bad time for people to run out and play amateur psychologist, but in the days that follow, we can start to assemble a picture of how this happened, why this might have happened, and what we know about the person. So there's been, really great watchdog and investigative reporting done about mass shootings. One that really stands out was in Fort Lauderdale. The Sun Sentinel did terrific reporting on the killer in the Parkland shootings. And
terrific reporting meaning what?
Meaning, I was about to get there. I think I'm talking too slow for radio.
No, you're right.
But, you know, it delved into all the red flags that were ignored. You know, the ways that the system failed to stop this very, very troubled young man who, my recollection is, was even seeking help and didn't get it, and who was sending ample signals that he was deeply disturbed. And so that, I think I'm correct in saying that reporting won a Pulitzer Prize.
Reporting about the system and
the
not
system,
the
system
person.
Failures, right. And so how can we do better? That kind of watchdog reporting, how can systems improve to hopefully at least reduce the number of mass shootings in this country?
We have a call from a listener who also wants to talk about the use of the killer's name. Rick in Strawberry Hill is joining the conversation at 816-235-2888. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, it drives me insane when they use the person's name because it's glorification of that person, dead or alive, among the people that believe like them. They should use the date, the county, the time if they want to, but nothing else. Almost like it's a case number. And just completely remove the name from that. Otherwise, they love it. They eat it up.
Yeah, I want to respond to that. It's a really, really good point. This friend of mine, well, he's one of my sort of colleagues in this effort. His name is Adam Lankford, and he's a criminologist at the University of Alabama.
Yeah, he's done a lot of the research that you cite.
He's done a lot of research, and he's not alone. I'm so happy to see that others are looking very closely at the connection between this wall-to-wall, unfettered coverage and the timing of subsequent mass shootings. So Adam has suggested that for people who want to know the name connected to the killing, that websites, news websites, create a sort of landing page where, you know, almost by code, you could link to that particular event and find out who the person was and where that case is in adjudication if the person, you know, in fact, wasn't killed by police or took his own life during the shooting, which is very common. And so his idea is to create a sort of almost a bit of a barrier to the information. You know, we know it's still going to be out there, and it's problematic because on social media and various places, people can speak directly to the world whose attention they seek. But it's clear, too, from the writing of some of these people that they want to be on TV. They want the attention of the world in a big way, you know, through mass media.
I want to jump in and say that, I mean, you've written about things journalists have said to you and pushing back on this idea. And one of the comments that stuck with me was from a newspaper editor who said we had to resist the Voldemort effect, that journalists can't give in to fear of he who must not be named. Is there something to that, that not speaking something gives it its own kind of power?
No. Okay. There isn't any. And my mistake on that panel was not saying, could you please cite the research that assertion is based on, because we have a huge body of research now, a growing body of research about this contagion risk. But you will not find in Google Scholar or any other search tool for scholarly research, you won't find any references to a Voldemort effect. She made that up, or somebody did, and so the pushback is basically no one is going to tell us how to report the news. And yet, news organizations do show restraint to protect people. It's something that we do. We've changed the way we cover suicide, for example, because there is a similar contagion risk in the coverage of suicide. And that has changed the way news organizations report that subject. Some people say to too great a degree. I'm still an editor, and I try very hard to do sort of, you know, stories about suicide that are more sort of public health model reporting and look at suicide trends, because obviously we have a really big problem with that in the United States. And in fact, we have more suicides by gun than homicides by gun. And it's not a subject that gets sufficient attention, in my opinion. But so news organizations can and do show restraint when public health is at risk. And we don't show people, you know, we don't create infographics to show people how to build bombs. And so, I mean, why is it so hard? I don't understand why it's so difficult for news organizations to look at the research and say, you know what, I may not be completely convinced, but let's err on the side of caution.
You know, you are, as you've mentioned, a journalist yourself. So you must have a feel for where people are coming from when, as journalists, they start seeking out every little detail, trying to look for something that might be relevant or useful when, you know, some of it is that, some of it is not. But trying to provide the fodder for that exhaustive style of coverage, it seems like part of it is trying to give people what they want, give people that people are out there with questions and they're trying to answer those questions. Is that your sense of what's motivating, I guess I should say, us to do it this way?
I think a big part of what's motivating us to do it that way is editors and producers. I think it's competition for eyeballs. I think that, you know, it's tough to stand up to an editor or a producer and say, you know, that kind of coverage is pretty irresponsible. I don't think we should do it.
Or like, this is the
just
big story, but I don't think we need to be talking about it.
You know, just because the TV station across town reported it doesn't mean we have to report it. I mean, this is why I am so focused on the development of ethical decision-making skills in reporting students in the reporting class that I teach here at the School of Journalism and in the course that I teach on covering traumatic events. You know, I think of sort of ethical decision-making skill as almost like a muscle that has to be developed. It has to get strong, and we have to get really good at articulating our arguments and citing the research. So here's the really interesting thing, and I want to go back to what you said, because this is what people want, is an assumption. We don't actually know that it's what people want just because they click on those stories. It's what we give them. If you put out only fried chicken at the buffet and everybody eats the fried chicken, it's the only choice on the buffet, you can't say, gosh, everybody loves fried chicken. You could say everybody's hungry. You know, it's not like we're giving them terrific choices. And it also, it's not as if we're explaining, taking the opportunity to be transparent and explain to audiences and readers why we have chosen not to report a story, why we've chosen to change the way we report a story. So I am all about transparency when it comes to showing respect for audiences and readers and explaining to them why we made a decision.
Or creating a two-way street, which is kind of what we're trying to do now. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what your experience of the media coverage of mass shootings has been like. Is the coverage itself helping you understand something, adding to your stress about mass shootings? What's been working for you about it? What hasn't been? We are the media, and this is your chance to talk to us about it at 816-235-2888. And Catherine, just quickly, I mean, there is also the question of how we in our journalism can inadvertently become part of the story and how it plays out, which is kind of what you've alluded to. It does feel like the media response is a crucial part of this scary cycle that keeps repeating itself. But can we as journalists always be anticipating outcomes, trying to cater to the outcomes we want or avoiding outcomes we don't want? Or is there some level of seek the truth, tell the story, whether I like it or not? I'm not a fortune teller. Period.
I think I understand your question. And yes, we have an obligation to bear witness. But the SPJ Code of Ethics requires us to reduce the harm in the way we cover the news. And if we have a growing body of research that shows that the way we're covering mass shootings might be contributing to more mass shootings by creating a risk of contagion, by giving people a platform to get attention for doing terrible things, then it would seem to me that we are very much within our, you know, ethical boundaries, right, by deciding to show restraint.
Keep those calls coming at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. We're talking about how coverage of mass shootings is affecting you with MU journalism professor Catherine Reed. And given the news from El Paso, we'd especially love to hear from Latino listeners about how you're processing the many layers of hurt plastered on TV screens right now. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm chatting with Catherine Reed of MU's Journalism School. She's joined us from Columbia to talk about her research on the impact of news coverage after mass shootings. She's been looking into it for a while, and she has an opinion piece coming out in the IRE Journal. That's a publication for investigative reporters and editors. It pairs a critique of the media response that we typically do see with pointers for getting it right and telling the stories without doing additional harm. Hi again, Catherine.
Hi, one quick correction.
Oh,
that's
sure.
Actually, that's an IRE Journal piece that came out earlier this
year. Oh, okay,
year.
Okay.
And I sent you a proof because it's, you know, it's hard to read online.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we are going to turn to our callers because we have a full switchboard. So let's go to what you want to tell us, the media, right now. Miranda is calling us from Lawrence. Hi, Miranda.
Hi.
What can you share?
Yeah, I think that one thing I've noticed in the coverage is there's a lot of de-emphasis on the victims and a lot of focus on the killer. And I think in a lot of those discussions, it sort of short-circuits the role that public policy plays in enabling these tragedies. I think that there's a lot of not nuanced analysis on why did the killer do this? Why, you know, and in the immediate aftermath. And I think that when we de-emphasize the victims, their stories, how many people, you know, what occurred with them, it sort of depersonalizes things. Like, these are people whose lives were lost. And I think that, I mean, especially with the comments from our president about, you know, this is a mental health issue. I got, you know, it's not the gun that did it. And I think it's sort of like, okay, let's stop for a second and think about what role public policy plays.
Miranda,
and enabling these tragedies.
So it sounds like you want more focus on policy.
Yeah, I think that in conjunction with, you know, these victim stories, I'd
humanizing
rather stop seeing, like, yeah, humanizing. I think that that's an issue that we have as a society. It's like, with so many of these tragedies occurring, like, what, it's upwards of 250 mass shootings, I feel like, I read in the past year or past
since
year?
January 1st.
Catherine, yeah, do you have numbers, Catherine?
Since January 1st, we've had more than 250.
What is your take on what Miranda's saying? I mean, it echoes on some level what you were saying before, but in addition to de-emphasizing the killer, she's talking about emphasizing the lives lost.
Absolutely. That's where the energy and attention should be focused in the immediate aftermath. Who was lost? You know, who died in that Aurora, Colorado theater?
Can I just jump in and say, though, also, someone on Twitter told me that what frustrates him about the coverage is when it turns into what he calls tragedy porn.
Yes, that's a problem, too. Yeah. And there is some fine line there. But just who were these people? Here's the person's photograph. And here's what they did in their life and who they left behind. And what their dreams were. Like, what were their plans in life? I want to go backwards for a second, though, and say something about this mental health thing. So some mass shooters do have a history of mental illness, but many do not. Okay?
You have to go to a therapist to get a diagnosis, though, is part of that, right? I only bring that up because the idea that we know everyone's mental health history and perhaps even like kind of create a scenario where having gone to a therapist is something.
Well, there are other factors that would help us predict much better whether someone is likely to commit a crime like this. And the Washington Post did a terrific story about this. And among those factors were a strong sense of resentment, this desire for fame, having studied other mass shootings, and especially the people who committed them, access to firearms, of course, narcissism, and then, interestingly, a history of domestic violence. That is a factor that connects many of these men.
Yeah. Let's talk to Janelle. Janelle is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Janelle.
Hi.
What can you share?
My thought is that the press does sensational journalism rather than responsible journalism. And by that I mean shoving a microphone in the face of someone in the hospital is just irresponsible. It would be much more useful if they were out chasing down legislators and getting them on a public record of would they support any kind of gun control. It's the gun that's killing people. If a mentally ill person couldn't get a hold of the gun, they couldn't pull the trigger. And we should not have military weapons out in the general public.
Well, Janelle, thanks for that call. I'm going to stick for now, Catherine, with this piece of it about chasing down legislators instead of families of victims.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you know what happens, and Janelle, I appreciate your comment very much. And here's what happens. When journalists bring up the problem of guns and the lack of gun control in the United States, they're immediately accused of politicizing the issue. But journalists are going to have thicker skins than that, because we in a certain way, the journalism that I see is sort of talking around the actual problem, which you so eloquently described in your comment, which is that if there weren't access, easy access to guns, then it, you know, we would still have a real challenge with providing mental health services to everybody in the United States who needs them, and mental health would still be a problem. But you wouldn't have this explosive combination of these resentful, angry, isolated publicity seekers, you know, being able to weaponize their anger and turn it into tragedy for scores and scores of people. And so it's a difficult kind of journalism to do. But increasingly, people are saying this is the kind of journalism they want.
You know, recently, Beto O'Rourke had this candid moment where he was like,
yes,
news media, WTF.
He
was talking about this an aspect of coverage which had to do with the questions he was being asked, which, if I understand him right, felt to him like journalists themselves weren't willing to connect the dots, and kept sort of incredulously asking him to do it for them.
Yes.
What do you make of that? Do journalists need to take on more of that assessment and judgment piece of informing in public, the public coming to conclusions? Because right now we are a little bit like, the toaster was on, the bread turned brown. Are the two related? Not for me to say.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, so there's been a lot of terrific reporting. I will push back a little bit on the last caller's comment about this, because it isn't all sensational. There's been great reporting done on access to guns, the lack of traceability of guns. I'm thinking about a great Washington Post thing they did about how many killers went into a uncle's house or a neighbor's house or their own home and got the guns that they needed to commit these crimes. Yes, guns are a really big problem, but the struggle is that it's difficult to push that anymore in front of the public without the public, the very strong, purist Second Amendment people pushing back really hard and accusing the media of being biased and of taking a stand against the Second Amendment. And even though polls show that there's a significant percentage of the American people who support reasonable gun control.
So does the thicker skin argument apply there too, or no?
Well, I think this is a conversation we have to have in newsrooms. I think that this is actually not just in newsrooms, probably as an industry. You know, it's the science is there. The research is there. The facts and the statistics are there. It's sort of, as you say, it's like talking around what's very, very obvious. And when you look at the statistics comparing the United States problem to other countries, gun deaths per year, and let's not forget that a huge percentage of those are suicide, which is another problem related to guns, there's just no question that it's access to guns that is a very significant part of why this is happening.
Let's talk to Richard in Grain Valley. Hi, Richard.
Hi. The only thing I wanted to mention, and I appreciate the fact that you discussed the issues of gun policy and the way we handle our liberties with regard to firearms, and that has to be discussed much more deeply. But what I wanted to say is, because my home country is Singapore, and I've lived all the way from there to London, I've seen how some of these things are reported. And I know in Asia, for example, this sort of thing is rarely given the kind of attention. And granted, the fact that because gun ownership and availability is so limited, when one of these things happens, is a big deal. But they don't get very much play because the governments in Asia do clamp down on publicity and this sort of stuff. And there is a certain amount of censorship, but they do allow the reporting of this. But they move it out of the front page very quickly. And they don't give it much play after the first maybe 48 hours. So simply because of all the things that you're discussing, we don't want to allow people to sensationalize it. We don't want people's... It doesn't serve the greater good is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, Richard, I have a couple of questions about what Richard has asked. One is, you know, when you talk about moving something off of the front page quickly, within journalism in the United States, the conversation is often when you see something moving off the front page quickly, the conclusion that people come to is that we have become desensitized to this news, that it, you know, it didn't even make the front page. People right. died and it didn't make the front page.
Right. Well, and then I've heard people recently saying that we have so many mass shootings and so much coverage of mass shootings that they're desensitized to them. And in fact, we've had another shooting today, right? That they're almost a daily occurrence has desensitized people. So I am not in any way supportive of government censorship of news.
Yeah, that was going to be my other
right.
question.
No, I'm not. And of course not. And I think that we can do better on our own, you know. I'm just pro research-based, evidence-based journalism. And if the research is there, and I've already said this, I'm going to say it one more time real quick. If the research is there that shows us that what we're doing is creating a harm, a potential harm, then we need to change what we're doing. And we need to do it on our own. And the powerful people in journalism who are trying to not let us have this conversation, because this little coalition I'm working with is trying to get some very influential people and news organizations like the Washington Post to talk about this topic. Let's come up with guidelines for responsible reporting of mass shootings, and they won't even have the conversation. That is a very bad sign to me for that news organization and its willingness to think about what it's doing and the impact it's having on its audiences. You know, the other thing about this coverage, the kinds of coverage we're seeing, is it's making us sick. It's literally making people feel awful, hopeless, powerless. And
yeah.
that gets us back to the issue of chasing down legislators. The public, the citizens of the United States have a job here, a role here. But if they feel hopeless and they feel despair, these things just keep happening and there's just nothing we can do about it. If our coverage makes them feel that way, then I really think that we are not fulfilling our mission in this democracy, which is to inform people in a way that makes them feel like active participants in their democracy and that there's something they can do to make the world a better place.
Let's talk to Anne. Anne is calling us from Independence. Hi, Anne.
Hi. So I have this analogy that ever since these mass shootings started that I've been thinking about. I have family in San Francisco, and when I first went to visit, we're driving across the Golden Gate Bridge, and my brother and sister were telling me the number of people that jump off the Golden Gate Bridge on a daily basis to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it was astronomical. I had no idea. And they used to write every person's name in the newspaper. And it was like, you know, suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge every single day. And the numbers just kept increasing and increasing and increasing. And so, you know, they were like, what are we going to do about this? This is a really bad problem. And so they finally, this went on for decades. They finally got a task force together and they decided, you know what, maybe this is a problem that we're putting their names in the newspaper. So they stopped putting the names in the newspaper of the people who jump off the bridge. And the last time I went to visit in San Francisco, there were these little buggies, kind of like a mini golf cart on both sides of the bridge. And I was like, what are those for? And these are like mental health counselors that go up and down the bridge, getting people from jumping off.
You know,
and so ever since these mass shootings started, I've been telling my husband, you know, they have got to stop publicizing these names of these killers, because that's what they're doing. They want all of this publicity. And that was the first thing that I thought of, was the suicide force did.
Thank you, Anne, for that call. Yeah, this example of an instance where the use of names versus non-use of names has actually, like, there's an example of that change occurring. Although, yeah, a different specific kind of phenomenon. But Catherine, can you talk about that? Is that?
Oh, I did. I mentioned the analogy just a little while ago to coverage of suicide. And the name is not quite the issue there, in my understanding of the research. And I'm very interested in what the caller had to say. I'd like to look up to see whether someone has actually found that kind of link between a practice and an outcome.
We have a
question. However, the guidelines for coverage of suicide, though, in a way, it's sort of related, and it is analogous in a way, because the groups that are focused on reducing suicide in the United States caution against focus on methods, single cause, which is another problem in coverage of mass shootings, and sort of glorification of the suicide, the person who has taken their life. And that glorification can sometimes present itself in coverage of vigils, you know, a candlelight services where, you know, people talk about this person is an angel now. This person has gone up to heaven, and pictures of people sort of crying in groups. There's some concern that that kind of coverage, you know, that those, of course, those things should happen for the survivors and the families and friends of people who've taken their lives. They need that for recovery from this kind of trauma. But whether news organizations, right. So whether news organizations should be covering them and the impact that might have on someone who's feeling such despair that they would like to think of how much their family and their friends will miss them when they're gone. That's the problem. That's the link right there. And so that's a conversation we've had in our newsroom here at the Columbia Missourian, which is, you know, how we're very careful about how we cover those stories and look often to stories that delve more deeply into what people are trying to do to reduce the suicide rate.
I wonder if you have any parting thoughts for us, things we didn't get to in this conversation that you want to be sure people are thinking about right now. This is very much in the news right now. And by people, I mean journalists and consumers of journalism.
Well, I think I want to speak directly to consumers of journalism. You know, the news organizations whose content you read, and hopefully the content you support with digital subscriptions, because we need you. Hopefully you're voting with your pocketbook. And if you are unhappy with the coverage of a particular news organization, let them know in no uncertain terms that you don't like this. This is not what you want. What you want is more stories about, you know, what are people in this country trying to do to solve this problem?
So communicate back.
Communicate.
To the news
organizations. Yep. Give them feedback.
MU Journalism Professor Catherine Reed, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine is on the front lines of the conversation about coverage of mass shootings within the journalism world, and she's joined us to talk about her recommendations to her fellow journalists. Up next, a guy who writes games that bring people together, as in physically together in the same place. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. Daniel Fox is a role-playing game writer and designer. He runs the program they have for games at Andrews McMeel. Do you know what that means? I did not until I started learning about Daniel and his job and the kind of amazing career path he's had based here in Kansas City. He called into our recent show about Dungeons & Dragons. His love of D&D inspired him to write his own game. He started a Kickstarter campaign to get it made, and it really took off. One thing led to another, and suddenly He just does this for a living. Well, he's just back from a big game conference thing, a tabletop game conference, and we're going to hear his story. Daniel Fox, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So in your own words, explain what you do.
Good question. I basically get to write games that allow people to explore fantasy personalities. So we kind of set aside ourselves and can be like knights and nobles and things like that and go on adventures and tell interesting stories.
You have brought in your game and it looks like a big textbook, like what I learned algebra from, which surprises me.
Yeah.
I didn't know games looked like that, especially role-playing games. I thought people kind of like basically made them up for themselves.
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, like I think our traditional experience with games is told through the perspective of like Monopoly or the Game of Life. With tabletop
Candyland.
Candyland too, that's right. Can't forget about it. Chutes and Ladders. Like but role-playing games are a little different. They kind of take place in the theater of the mind, as we call it, and we use these books to allow us to explore all these different personas and types of characters that we can create. And while the books may look large and physically intimidating, they're really just kind of a book full of really cool things we can explore in ways that we can kind of tell stories in intriguing ways while still operating within like a rough or framework, if you will, of how you just make decisions on whether things succeed or fail within the story.
This is a crazy dream job for you, right?
Yeah, completely. Looking back, you know, when I was a kid, I never would have anticipated landing anywhere where I'm at now. You know, I started playing Dungeons and Dragons when I was 12 years old. I've been playing role-playing games since then. I'm 42. I'm going to age myself here. But
42 is a fine age to be,
that's
I
right.
say, as a fellow 42-year-old.
Yeah, but I mean, my career path has been really kind of crazy. I worked for the railroad for a while. I worked in advertising for a long time, and eventually it kind of led to this point where I'm at now at Andrews McMeel Universal as their executive creative director of games. And
it all happened because of a fairly random decision you made, not knowing where it would lead, to write your own game. You'd been playing D&D for a long time, as I mentioned, and I have to assume you enjoyed it. But what was it you weren't getting from that game that made you want to write a new one?
That's a great question. So Dungeons & Dragons kind of promotes like a high fantasy experience. So if you think about like Lord of the Rings or other television shows that kind of lean toward the more fantastical elements, that kind of caters to that.
Yeah, everyone has wind in their long hair.
That's right. The wind is blowing and Arwen and all Capes. That fun stuff.
Yeah, go on. I can picture it.
Yeah, so I think over the years, like, you know, my taste certainly can lean toward dark fantasy. So things like Game of Thrones, if you will, as well as a number of console games like Demon Souls and Dark Souls. And there's certainly kind of this sea change, so to speak, in the industry where people are turning toward more mature stories like The Wire or The Sopranos. And when people kind of seek stories that kind of raise a more mature level than opposed to the high fantasy level, they turn toward dark fantasy.
Can really like almost imagine like a collective shriek being emitted at your calling, like by saying that this is more mature, you are saying something about the maturity level of the other option.
Not necessarily. I feel that dark fantasy, unlike high fantasy. Yeah, so if we use Dungeons and Dragons versus Viander, like Dungeons and Dragons is told in a way, there's certainly a level of catharsis, I feel, being able to basically go and plunder the dungeon and win stuff and defeat evil. But games like dark fantasy, such as Zweihänder, kind of play more toward like the moral story, the things.
Zweihänder, that's the game you wrote.
That's right, Zweihänder. And in Missouri, we call it Zweihänder. So mispronunciation is totally on brand. I told Melody that earlier,
my
too.
My producer.
Yeah.
That's so funny. So, you wrote this other game. How did you go about that? How did you know how to write a game?
Well, I took everything that I knew about Dungeons and Dragons that I liked, and I kind of set it to one side, and everything else that I didn't like, I said, I'm going to fill in those gaps with my own approach. And it took a lot of time, because when you write games, you're not just writing it in a vacuum. You have people who are playtesting. So I have a group of people I've been playing with, you know, for years, who we game every Wednesday in my basement still, like the true nerds we are.
I love it.
and when we develop games, we playtest game mechanics, we playtest approaches, and we find the rules that work right to tell the type of stories we want to tell, to play toward the more mature human stories. And that's kind of how I guess in brief, like how you write a game. You just try things out, see what people like.
What is it that you write down?
Yeah, so really it's just about like, so if you think about it from the perspective of like, if you're reading a book, right, and you've got these protagonists in the story and you're turning the pages and learning about what happens to them as the storyteller, the author is kind of, in a sense, narrating. On the same token, from the perspective of RPGs,
role-playing games.
That's right, role-playing games. A game master or is basically telling a story. And the choices that people who make their own characters or protagonists of the story, they'll make choices in the story, in the game.
So how do you write that, though?
With a pen and paper and a lot of revisions and Google Sheets and a lot of just kind of a lot of stress testing, like making certain things feel right to resolve actions in the story. For me, I started on paper. Literally, I'm like the manila folding, like those big, huge sheets of paper, and then eventually moved to Google Docs, where I started collaborating with other writers too to kind of make certain it all kind of came together right. But I'd never written anything before my entire life.
Is it a little like Mad Libs?
A little bit, yeah. In some sense, I think you could qualify it that
like,
way.
You've written it to a point, and then there's like a do a thing here.
That's right. That's right. And the beauty of RPGs is that you kind of like, unlike other games, like. I think the most confounding question that RPGs propose to somebody who's never played is the first time they're asked, what would you like to do? Because in traditional games, like in Monopoly, like you got to go around the board, you roll dice, you get cards and get money and go to jail and that stuff. But in RPGs, you're kind of given this opportunity to like explore whatever you want, however you want, and from the perspective of your character within the milieu, you if you will, of the game's rule set.
So this brings me back to, though, like, this is different from Monopoly in all of the ways you have explained, but you have just returned from a conference where you were at specifically for tabletop gaming.
That's right. So I just,
which sounds very Monopoly-esque.
As a matter of fact, Monopoly is there. It's called Gen Con. It takes place in Indianapolis. There's about 70,000 attendees. It's massive. I mean, shoulder to shoulder, full of people who are there to play games with their friends, their family, with strangers. Now that role-playing games and board games have been around for a long time, a lot of people bring their children as well. And it's literally wall-to-wall games, booths you can go to, experiences you can have with other game creators, and get an opportunity to really try new games that have come out in the market.
So new games, like when you talk about tabletop games, that is that more like what maybe like I played with my grandparents, like at the dining room table with little pegs that you move around and such?
Yeah, in a sense. I think that, you know, tabletop games can take the form of pen and paper and dice. It can take the form of an actual board game. There are many different ways we can interpret tabletop role-playing games. But for perspective of when I think about role-playing games, I think about the perspective of in the theater of the mind with Dungeons and Dragons and Zweihänder.
Tell me a like describe a tabletop role-playing game that you experienced at Gen Con that is sort of like embodies for you the direction of this genre.
Good question. So I think around the perspective of the games that I kind of run. So there's one storyteller, the narrator, if you will, the game master, and there are 4 to 5 people sitting around a table, you know, 4 by 8 usually, because you want lots of room for drinks and snacks and books and dice and all that fun stuff. And the narrator,
emphasis on snacks.
That's right, absolutely. And beer, if it's you know, if you're into adult drinks, which you should be, but if you're playing D&D. But the traditional experience is that you've got one game master, the storyteller, telling this story, and the players around the table who've created their own characters, these personas, are making decisions in story as the game master narrates, and their decisions will change and evolve the story as the game goes on. So even though some RPGs will use miniature figures or a board, most tabletop RPGs such as Zweihänder or Dungeons and Dragons will rely strictly on like what the people can envision and describe around the table in the same way that we read a book.
Is this, do you see a societal value in this sort of like physical gathering to play a game? Like around a table makes that very concrete, you know?
Yeah. And I think that we can look at this, there's this kind of return to analog. And what I mean by that is that our generation now is turning back toward face-to-face interactions, and role-playing games are an interesting and intriguing way to get away from the digital experience and lean back toward the interactive face-to-face experience through the lens of RPGs.
Do you think that this is like the direction of gaming going forward, or just a direction of gaming going
forward?
It
is the direction of gaming, absolutely.
Whoa, bold, bold stance. Well, so thank you so much, Daniel Fox, for talking to us. We have so much more that we could talk about still, and hopefully we'll do that. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Daniel is the executive creative director of games at Andrews McMeel, and it all started with a game he wrote in his spare time, which he used a Kickstarter campaign to actually make. Now he does this for a living for a big company, which is pretty cool. That's a wrap for today. Both of this morning's conversations will be available at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. Check out anything you might have missed. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we've got a food show for you, Distilleries, Apps and Snacks. Tune in at 10. It should be a fun one. You can start recommending your favorite apps and snacks on KC Menus on Twitter. Right now, we are at KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Knickendorf and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.